Module 5 is Preparing for Hazards. This covers Chapter 5 in the textbook and actually represents the first of four consecutive modules where we'll be focusing on the different types of risks in the risk quadrant. We'll talk about hazard risks in this module. We'll talk about operational risks. We'll talk about financial risks. And we'll talk about strategic risks in the next three modules. But we're going to focus on hazard risk in this particular module, and if you look at your handout, the risk quadrant handout, that includes property risk, liability risk, and personnel loss exposures. So let's get out our study sheet, and as you can see, we will focus on property risk, the sources of property risk, different ways property is valued after there's a loss. We'll talk about liability risk, and that includes human resource risk. We'll start off, though, by talking about property risk sources. We'll talk about natural disaster loss control, life safety. This is making sure that people are not injured or die if there's a fire. Physical property valuation. We'll then turn our attention to liability risk management and human resource risk. Let's start off by talking about property risk sources. Categorizing sources of risk can help provide a framework for managing risk exposures. So it is important to categorize the sources of risk, although the problem is no categorization method is perfect. Some sources can fall into more than one category, such as building collapse. There are two main categories that you must know for your exam. You will be tested on this. And the physical risk can generally be categorized as either natural risk, which would include something like an earthquake or a flood, or human risk, which would include human error or theft. Let's go through each one of these two types of categories. The first one is natural risk. Natural risks occur randomly in nature, encompasses natural disasters that can affect communities, and may include events that just affect a single organization, such as a sinkhole. That could affect just one organization, even though that's considered natural risk. Natural risk sources are typically beyond human control. We can't stop an earthquake from happening. We can't stop a flood from happening necessarily. We can't stop a tornado from happening. Risk management has little effect on reducing the likelihood of an event, but what we can affect is the consequences. We can't really reduce the likelihood of a natural risk, but we can affect the consequences. So even though risk management can't control the likelihood of these events, risk management can actually control the consequences of events by implementing loss reduction measures. Let's say that there's a manufacturing organization that's in Colorado, and they don't feel as though they have any exposure to hurricanes, which being in Colorado, that makes sense. But what if that organization has their only supplier located in South Florida, where there's a tremendous exposure to hurricanes? Proper planning for this manufacturer would include having a backup supplier. So loss reduction measures can be implemented to help control the consequences of events. Some of these natural risk sources include things like earthquake, landslide, volcanic eruption. Fire is a natural risk source, but it could also be a human risk source. Remember, we said some of these events could be categorized as both, could be in more than just one category. Fire is an example. If the fire started by a human, that's a human risk, not a natural risk. But fire certainly could be in the natural risk category. Flood is in the natural risk category. Hail, ice, mold, mildew, lightning, perils of the air or sea, rust, rot, tidal waves, and vermin. And there are even other events that would be classified as natural risk sources, such as drought, even meteors, tornadoes, erosion. Collapse could be included under natural risk sources. Let's say that a lot of snow and ice forms on the roof of a building, causing the building to collapse. That could cause it to fall in natural risk sources as well, although it could theoretically fall under human risk sources, also collapse could. The other category is human risk. Human risk sources include deliberate acts of individuals or groups, such as vandalism or terrorism. It also includes events that are not deliberate, but involve some type of human intervention. Risk control techniques can typically manage the likelihood and consequences. For example, if an organization is worried about vandalism, they could hire a security team and put security precautions in place to help protect the building. There are various sources of human risk, and that includes arson, embezzlement, terrorism, collapse. Remember, collapse could be natural risk, but it's certainly something that could be human risk. Explosion, sonic boom, strikes, riot, vandalism, and theft are all human risk. Power outage, electrical overload, contamination, pollution, and war, and even human error would be considered a source of human risk. So let's do a practice question. Which one of the following statements is correct regarding natural risk sources? They can be easily controlled and prevented. What we can do is we can help control the consequences, but the actual sources, the hurricanes, tornadoes, those are not easily controlled. Those really can't be controlled, so A is false. They can include events that just affect one organization. That's absolutely true. A natural event, a natural risk, that can affect an entire city, it can affect an entire country, but it could affect just one organization, so B is our answer. They include deliberate acts of individuals or groups. Well, that's false. That's human risk sources. And D, there's no way to reduce their impact. The impact can be reduced through risk control measures. So D is false. Once again, B is our answer. Let's talk about natural disaster loss control. Risk managers can attempt to mitigate and limit losses caused by natural disasters. Remember, we said earlier that we really can't control a natural disaster. We can't stop it from happening, but we can attempt to mitigate and limit losses caused by natural disasters. It's generally impossible to control these events, though. Organizations must have plans in place to deal with potential losses from catastrophes, because catastrophes can strike with little warning. With a hurricane, we usually have a warning, usually a few days. However, tornadoes don't give us such warning, typically. Risk managers should have both pre-loss and post-loss plans. Let's talk about some common natural disasters and potential pre-loss and post-loss plans that might be good for an organization. We'll start by talking about windstorms. A windstorm produces high winds with little or no rain. Some windstorms can actually be tracked for days. However, other windstorms allow only enough time to seek immediate shelter. A disaster recovery plan should include not only weather conditions, but difference in warning times. We may not get much notice. It may actually just be a few minutes, just enough to take shelter. The greatest threat from windstorm is building damage, but what we must consider is weather conditions and difference in warning times. Let's go through some pre-loss actions for windstorm, and then we'll talk about some post-loss actions for windstorm. Some pre-loss actions for windstorm include designing buildings to withstand anticipated wind loads, using storm shutters and blinds, and those storm shutters and blinds should be rated to handle higher wind loads, keeping roof and walls in good repair, provide adequate supports for outside structures, and secure equipment located outside the facility. These are all actions for windstorm that should occur before a windstorm causes any damage. But let's say that we do have a windstorm and it causes some damage. What are some post-loss actions? Have the organization ready to use spare construction materials to reduce further loss, such as plywood panels, tarps, plastic sheets. Those can prevent further loss. Have security on the premises to prevent looting or vandalism. Those are some post-loss actions for windstorm. Another type of common natural disaster is a tornado. A tornado is a violent windstorm consisting of up to 300 mile per hour winds. Your study guide may say 300 plus miles per hour. That's a typo. The tornado has winds of up to 300 miles per hour. Nothing can prevent property losses when a tornado makes direct contact. However, bodily injury can be reduced by taking shelter. Pre-loss actions are very difficult with respect to a tornado because most structures cannot withstand a tornado. Reinforced concrete construction has withstood a tornado in some cases, but it's not practical, nor is it economically feasible to make all buildings have reinforced concrete construction throughout. So unfortunately, there's not a lot to do with respect to pre-loss actions. However, installing underground shelters can provide a safe place during evacuation, and that can reduce or eliminate bodily injury. There are several post-loss actions that can be taken after a tornado has occurred. One is preserve life, clear the rubble, begin a search and rescue process, make temporary repairs, and then begin salvage procedures. But those salvage procedures should not begin until safety has been ensured. Another common type of natural disaster is an earthquake. Location is a key factor in mitigating earthquake damage and injuries. So earthquake risk control measures include selecting an appropriate geographic region and appropriate site within that region to have the organization located. Stable earth can absorb seismic waves better than unstable ground. Evaluating earthquake loss exposures normally involves a geologic analysis, and earthquakes themselves cannot be prevented. So really, from a pre-loss standpoint, there are a couple of things that can be done. One is selecting the right location for the organization. And another pre-loss action that could be taken for earthquake is having proper design of building and structures. There are two types of earthquake-resistant building design that you need to know for your exam. The first type is box action. That's earthquake-resistant construction that integrates roof and floor diaphragms that can flex. You may want to note that box action is used in buildings that are under 3 stories tall. So box action is under 3 stories tall. Another type of earthquake-resistant construction is frame action, and that relies on the resilience of steel or reinforced concrete to absorb energy. So that's a great pre-loss action. Make sure that there's proper design of the building and structures. And as we already said, another pre-loss action, make sure the organization selects an appropriate geographic location. Once an earthquake occurs, there are several post-loss actions that can be taken. Caring for injured individuals, protecting uninjured individuals, safeguarding endangered property, reinforcing weakened buildings, providing temporary housing for individuals if they've been displaced due to the earthquake, and then finally beginning the restoration efforts. But of course, those restoration efforts should not begin until the danger of further seismic activity passes. Another common type of natural disaster is flood. Both inland and coastal areas can be subject to flooding resulting from rain or tides. Earthquakes can cause tidal waves, and those tidal waves can travel at up to 600 miles per hour in deep water. There are several pre-loss actions for flood. One of them is to evaluate the location of operations, and having a location, an operation, in a flood-prone area may not be the best idea. Analyzing structures in flood zones, that's another pre-loss action for flood. Using temporary levees, also we can use shutters for building openings, we can use barriers, that's another one. Obtaining disaster supplies, such as portable power equipment, is a great pre-loss action for flood. And placing electrical service equipment on upper floors of buildings so they're outside of that area that can be subject to the flood. You don't want to put them on the ground floor where they can be flooded. Floods can often lead to a fire, and there are several pre-loss actions that can be taken to minimize flood-related fire. One of them is to allow no open flames near flood-exposed structures, protecting flammable gas piping, and preventing flood water from entering buildings. There are a few post-loss actions for flood as well. We can assess the damage, paying particular attention to building foundations, making temporary repairs, beginning salvage operations, and cleaning and inspecting electrical equipment. Of course, we want to make sure we clean and inspect the electrical equipment before we attempt to restart any of that electrical equipment. So let's do a practice question. Which one of the following is an earthquake-resistant building design that relies on the resilience of steel to absorb energy while undergoing considerable distortion? When we're relying on the resilience of steel, we mentioned before that that's a type of frame action design. So C is our answer. Let's talk about life safety. If a fire occurs in a building, of course the building could be subject to property damage and maybe even significant property damage. But in addition to property damage, there may be loss of life or significant injuries to individuals. Life safety involves making sure individuals are not in danger if a fire occurs in a building. When considering building safety, of course we have to look at the construction materials used in the building. We have to look at the floor plan of the building as well. But fire safety also includes who occupies the building. Fire loss control requires a large amount of advance planning because a fire occurs without warning. And there are some natural disasters that occur with several days of warning, such as a windstorm, but fire is typically not one of them. Fire usually occurs without any warning whatsoever, and therefore fire loss control requires a large amount of advance planning. The health and mobility of a building's occupants affects their safety in the event of a fire. Life safety engineers have actually identified 6 characteristics of individuals and groups that affect their susceptibility to injury or death if a fire breaks out in a building. Of those 6 characteristics, 4 of them are characteristics that affect individuals, and 2 of them are characteristics that affect groups. Let's go through the 4 characteristics first that affect individuals. So what are the characteristics that affect an individual's susceptibility to injury or death if there's a building fire? The first characteristic affecting individuals is the individual's age. Very old or very young may have limited mobility and altered awareness. A second characteristic that affects individuals is mobility. If it is difficult for an individual to move, fatality rates in a fire may be higher. A third characteristic that affects individuals is awareness of the fire. The survival rate is affected by the state of the individual. Was the individual awake or asleep at the time of the fire? Were they sober? Were they drunk at the time of the fire? Were they distracted at the time of the fire? That would affect their susceptibility to injury or death. And then finally, the last characteristic that affects individuals is knowledge of the building. Familiarity with a building can save lives. If you work in an office, you're probably much more familiar with the layout of that office, the floor plan of that office, than you are the layout of a local shopping mall. So if there's a fire at your office, you may have a higher likelihood of escaping quickly than if there's a fire in the local shopping mall. Those are the 4 characteristics that affect individuals' susceptibility to injury or death in the case of a building fire. There are 2 characteristics that affect groups, and the first one is the density of the group. Less crowded buildings enable occupants to escape more quickly and reduce the number of injuries, the number of deaths. Crowd control is another characteristic that affects groups. Discipline leads to less panic during a fire, which generally leads to less injury, less death. Those are the six characteristics that you need to know for the exam. You need to know the four that apply to individuals and the two that apply to groups. In addition to being affected by human characteristics, there are several other elements that need to be considered when planning for life safety. A risk manager and safety engineer need to consider the following building elements: construction, occupancy, protection, and external exposures. There are actually 12 classes of occupancy that are considered. For example, one of them is educational, and that could consist of a large number of young people inside the building. There's healthcare, and that could consist of a group of people that are unable to take care of themselves. Other occupancy classifications include business, industrial, storage. There are actually 12 classes of occupancy that need to be considered. To help prevent injury and death caused by fire, safety engineers develop specific fire safety standards for buildings, and those standards have been codified in the Life Safety Code. The Life Safety Code has been published by the National Fire Protection Association, and risk management professionals must ensure that buildings comply with its provisions. The provisions vary among the classes of occupancy, and there are several Life Safety Code risk control measures. We're not going to go through each one of them, but here are a few main ones. Buildings must provide sufficient number of exits. Exits should be unobstructed and visible. Buildings must provide at least 2 means of egress. Buildings must incorporate adequate lighting. Those are all included in the Life Safety Code. In addition, fire alarms need to be installed. Doorways need to be clearly marked. There are several provisions under the Life Safety Code. So let's do a practice question. Which one of the following represents a characteristic that affects a group's susceptibility to injury or death resulting from a building fire? So we're looking for a group characteristic, not an individual characteristic. Remember, we had 6 characteristics, 4 applied to individuals, 2 applied to groups. Knowledge of the building was a characteristic that applied to individuals. So A is false. Gender was not a characteristic that was considered in the list of 6 characteristics, so B is false. Density is a characteristic that applies to groups. Remember, it was density and crowd control, so C is our answer. And we also have sensitivity, which was not one of the characteristics. Once again, C is our answer. Let's talk about different ways of valuing property. A risk manager must know the value of an asset in order to protect it from risk. There are actually several different ways that an asset can be valued, depending on what you're trying to do. If you're doing financial statements, there's one way of valuing assets. There are different ways of valuing assets for insurance purposes. For this exam, you're responsible for knowing the difference between 4 different valuation methods: book value, replacement cost, market value, and economic value. Let's talk about each one of those. The first valuation method is book value. This is really an accounting concept. If you've ever looked at a company's balance sheet, the assets on the balance sheet, at least the long-term assets like buildings and equipment, those are valued based on book value. Book value is calculated as historical cost less accumulated depreciation. Historical cost is the original cost of the property plus the cost of any improvements or other additions. For example, let's say that I purchased a building 10 years ago for $20 million and I've made no improvements to the building since then. My historical cost of the building is $20 million. Accumulated depreciation is an allowance that's taken on my financial statements for the wear and tear of the building. Over time, the building's going to suffer some wear and tear, and we need to account for that on a balance sheet and on an income statement through accumulated depreciation. So let's say that I bought the building for $20 million, and over the last 10 years, I've taken depreciation deductions in total of $2 million. That means my book value is $18 million, the historical cost of $20 million minus $2 million of accumulated depreciation, $18 million. Generally, the book value is lower than the market value due to inflation. Just because I'm showing that building as being valued at $18 million on my balance sheet, that doesn't mean the building's really worth $18 million. Due to inflation and in general the real estate market and how real estate tends to go up in value, I could probably sell that building now for $23 million, even though the book value is only $18 million. So book value is generally lower than market value due to inflation. Risk managers generally do not rely on book value for valuing property, although it may serve as a good starting point. Remember, book value is really what's used for financial statements. It's not really used very much for risk management. And as I said before, historical cost is the original cost of property, but it also includes commissions that were paid when I bought the property, any closing costs, and any subsequent capital improvements made to the property. Another method of valuing property, which is used quite often for insurance purposes, is replacement cost. Replacement cost is commonly used for buildings and in some cases personal property as well. Replacement cost represents the current cost to repair, rebuild, or purchase new property of like kind and quality. Oftentimes with homeowners policies, we see the house itself valued at replacement cost for insurance purposes, which means if my house burned down, the insurance company would pay to replace my house, whatever the cost is, using like kind and quality materials. Replacement cost for a building is the cost of constructing a new building. Cost can be estimated with a high degree of accuracy. Some buildings, though, have a low economic value but a high replacement cost. For example, there are these Airbus planes that have a tail that's 7 stories high, and so it's going to require major adjustments to hangars because most hangars are not large enough to be able to house this Airbus plane. And so a building, an old hangar, might have low economic value, but to replace it, it might have a high replacement cost. One offshoot of replacement cost is the functional valuation method. That's a method in which the insurer is required to replace property with a functional equivalent. It may not be an exact perfect replacement of like kind and quality materials, but we may not need like kind and quality materials. This is used when replacing property with a like kind is not practical. With real property, the insurer must use common construction materials. And this may be appropriate when valuing historical buildings or even old network servers. Let's say that I purchased a few years ago a network server, and at the time it was the top-of-the-line server. Over the years, it's become somewhat obsolete, but it still functions as I need it to function. So if my server was destroyed under the functional valuation method, we would value that replacement cost as not what it would take to buy a new server that's brand new, top of the line. We would value it as what it would take to replace the server with a functional replacement. It could be an older server that does what my original server did. So we don't always need to replace the property with brand new property that's exactly the same as the old property. We can sometimes use a functional replacement, and therefore we'd value the property at the functional valuation method. We also have what's called market value or fair market value. That's the price a willing buyer would pay a willing seller on the open market. It's useful for valuing products that are indistinguishable from one another. Products such as commodities like grain, they have a daily determinable market value. We could even use this method for automobiles, just using the Blue Book value. I see this a lot with houses. Let's say that I'm selling my house. What's the value of my house? I can get an appraiser and they could say the value is $200,000, Or we can look and see what I paid for it originally, $180,000. That's the historical cost. But that really doesn't matter, does it? Really, the value of my house is whatever I can sell it for to a willing buyer. So if, let's say, you're willing to pay $230,000 for the house, then isn't that really the market value of the house, the fair market value, what a willing buyer would pay a willing seller? So that's another method of valuing property. And then finally, we have economic value. Economic value is the value of property based on its ability to generate income. We might value a rental property based on its ability to generate rental income. It could be used to value a machine, the leasehold value of a rental property. Economic value represents the property's contribution to the organization's overall net worth. So let's do a practice question. Mark bought a house for $30,000 in 1975. With inflation and an increased cost of labor, home values have increased. Mark has decided to sell his house and move to a new city. The depreciation on Mark's house is $20,000, and it was appraised at $80,000. He sells his house for $95,000 within 2 weeks of putting it on the market. The market value of Mark's house is, we've got $30,000, $75,000, we've got $80,000, $95,000. And what's the answer? The answer is $95,000. If we're looking for the market value, also known as fair market value, it's whatever a willing buyer would pay a willing seller. And in this case, a willing buyer paid Mark $95,000. So D is our answer. Now that we've covered property risk management, let's talk a little bit about liability risk management. Like property risks, liability risks are hazard risks that require a holistic risk management approach. We're going to talk about three main types of liability risk. We'll focus on directors and officers' liability, employment practices, and we'll also focus on fiduciary obligations. Directors and officers' liability is a very important liability that needs to be addressed by any organization. Directors and officers actually do have a fiduciary duty, not only to the organization, but to the shareholders of the organization as well. And that's an extremely high level of care. Directors can be held liable, personally liable, for failing to fulfill their responsibilities as a director. And the common responsibilities of a director of an organization are the following. Directors establish the organization's basic goals. They elect and appoint officers. Officers include the CEO, the president, the secretary, the treasurer of the company. Those are all officers. They're appointed and managed by the directors. Directors also safeguard and approve changes in the organization's assets. That's another one of their responsibilities. They approve important financial matters pertaining to the organization, maintain the corporate charter and bylaws, they delegate special powers to others, and very important, they act as a fiduciary to the shareholders. They have a fiduciary duty. They do owe a duty to the corporation, to the organization itself, but their primary fiduciary duty is to the shareholders of the company. Directors and officers have a fiduciary duty. And what does that mean? That means that they have the following duties to the organization and to the shareholders. And you do need to be aware of what these duties are, what these fiduciary duties are. The first one is the duty of care. A director, an officer, they must act in good faith and in the organization's best interest. They also have a duty of loyalty. A director cannot take business opportunities away from the organization. Let's say that I'm a director of an organization and you're a potential customer, but instead of having you do business with our organization, what I do is I send you over to my brother's competing organization because he's struggling a little bit. If that's the case, I have breached my duty of loyalty. I have a duty of loyalty to the organization in which I'm a director. In addition, part of my duty of loyalty is I cannot use insider information to purchase or sell the organization's stock. I have a tremendous duty of loyalty to the shareholders, so I cannot use insider information to benefit. There's also a duty of disclosure. Material facts must be disclosed to those who have a right to know. Directors must disclose important facts to shareholders and potential investors. And then finally, there's a duty of obedience. Directors and officers must perform duties in accordance with laws as well as the corporate charter. So these are the duties that a director owes and an officer owes: the duty of care, duty of loyalty, duty of disclosure, and duty of obedience. And a breach of one or more of those duties can result in a director being personally liable for any losses incurred. There is director and officer insurance, but that only transfers the financial risk, or at least some of the financial risk can be transferred with D&O insurance. Unfortunately, that insurance cannot transfer or restore an organization's reputation. So this is a major potential liability for any organization. Organizations are also subject to employment practices liability risks. That includes, for example, discrimination. A company can be sued by its employees for discrimination. That includes overt discrimination, obvious discrimination, disparate treatment, which would be, for example, penalizing women for arriving late to work, but not penalizing men for arriving late to work. That's disparate treatment. Also, it includes disparate acts. For example, let's say an organization requires all employees to attend one particular religious service, even though some of the employees do not practice that particular religion. That's a disparate act. That all falls under the category of discrimination, and a company can get sued for that. Wrongful termination is also a potential liability for corporations. Another employment practices liability risk is sexual harassment. Some risks come from the perception that the employer created a hostile work environment. Retaliation is another potential liability risk. Members of the management team retaliate against an employee because of a legitimate action taken by the employee. Let's say an employee is injured on the job and they file a workers' comp claim, and so the company fires them. The employee that got fired could sue the company for retaliation. There are several ways that companies can manage their employment practices liability risk. For example, companies can make sure that their hiring practices conform to federal and state regulations, and companies can also make sure to adequately document all their hiring practices in an employee handbook. Another type of liability risk is fiduciary liability risk. We mentioned that directors and officers are in fact fiduciaries of a company. There are other fiduciaries as well. Fiduciary liability risks generally apply to employee benefit plans. That would include retirement plans like a 401k plan or a profit sharing plan, a defined benefit plan, or other employee benefit plans. The beneficiaries of these plans may file a lawsuit against the employer, and the employer has a fiduciary duty. And what that means is that there's an incredibly high standard of care. What's scary to note is that if someone is managing, administering a retirement plan, they're a fiduciary, and they could be sued by the beneficiaries of that plan. And if they lose, what's going to happen is the fiduciary is going to be personally liable for those losses. A fiduciary is personally liable for losses resulting from a breach of duty. Let's say that I'm managing the profit-sharing plan for our organization, and you're one of the participants. You're an employee. You're in the profit-sharing plan. And I make a decision to invest the entire profit-sharing plan in our own company's stock. And then our stock becomes worthless, and now the profit-sharing plan is completely worthless. The balance is zero. You could actually sue me, and I'm personally responsible for those losses. When we talk about fiduciary duty for a plan sponsor, it's very similar to some of the duties that we talked about with a director or officer. Let's go through the fiduciary duties for a plan sponsor, and you'll see the similarities. First of all, there's a duty of loyalty. You remember that there was a duty of loyalty that directors had as well. For a plan fiduciary, they've got a duty of loyalty. Their actions must be in the best interest of the plan and the plan's participants. There's a duty of prudence. A fiduciary's duties must be carried out with the care and skill of a prudent person. There's a duty of diversification. Let's highlight this one. This is very important. This is not one that we saw with directors, but this is one that applies to plan fiduciaries. Investments must be diversified within the plan, not to guarantee a gain. Fiduciaries do not have to guarantee a gain, but what fiduciaries have to do is minimize the risk of large losses. In my example, where I invested all of our company's profit-sharing plan assets in our company stock, that was not adequate diversification. I did not minimize the risk of large losses there. And then finally, the last duty is duty of adherence, which is similar to the duty of obedience that we talked about before. The fiduciary must act according to the plan documents and applicable law. So let's do a practice question. Which one of the following represents a duty that a corporate director owes to the shareholders of the corporation? And we have duty of integrity, duty of obedience, duty of diligence, and duty of independence. Well, these are all good things, but there's only one of these that we talked about being an actual fiduciary duty for a director. And if you remember, we mentioned that the director does owe a duty of obedience. That was one of the duties that were owed. So B is our answer. If you remember, it was a duty of loyalty, duty of disclosure, duty of obedience, and duty of care, but not duty of integrity, not duty of diligence, and not duty of independence. So B is our answer. Let's wrap up Module 5 by talking about human resource risk. Human resource risk relates to the risk associated with an organization's employees. Employees can be an organization's biggest asset, but they can also represent the organization's greatest risk. An organization faces many liability risks arising from employee behavior, and that includes work-related injury and illness, retirement and resignation, and work-related violence. We'll talk about each one of these three separately. Risk managers must try to limit the hazard risks presented in the course of employment. Let's start by talking about work-related injury and illness. Risk managers should consider both injuries and illnesses when designing a risk management plan, and you need to know the difference between injury and illness for your exam. Injury usually occurs due to an external physical force exerting stress on the body. A box falls off a shelf and hits an employee and injures them. Illnesses, however, tend to happen over time. So injuries are usually immediate. Illnesses tend to happen over time. Risk control depends on whether a disability is caused suddenly or by a prolonged exposure. Personal inspection is a valuable method to help determine if there are workplace hazards present. So let's take a look at some of the major categories of work-related injury. So we're talking about injury now, not illness. We'll talk about illness in just a second. But these are the major categories of work-related injuries. Machinery and equipment use. One way to help prevent that, or at least minimize it, is using sensors. Sensors can help prevent injuries. They can alert a user of danger. Materials handling is another category of work-related injury. For that, we can use wearables to monitor posture and weight load. Vehicle fleet operations is another category of work-related injury. Telematics can be used to measure driver safety. And then finally, we've got physical condition, the physical condition of the premises. Sensors and alarms can notify management of danger. And if you remember before when we were talking about life safety, we mentioned that there are different factors that need to be considered with respect to a building, with respect to a premises, and we talked about that risk managers need to consider construction, occupancy, protection, and the external environment. Those all need to be considered. There are various sources of work-related illness as well. Long-term chemical exposure, radiation, noise levels, ergonomic stress, extreme temperatures, and poor air quality are all sources of work-related illness. Another human resources risk is retirement and resignation. If an employee retires or resigns, the loss to the organization is the future value the individual would have provided, and it can vary greatly depending on who it is that retired or resigned. For example, if a vice president retires or resigns, that could be a tremendous loss to the organization as compared to if an entry-level person left. For larger corporations, this risk must be considered from an enterprise-wide perspective. The organization needs to look at all workforce demographics. If the organization consists primarily of younger workers, then there's the chance that there could be mass resignations. If the organization consists predominantly of older workers, then that could result in mass retirements. And finally, we have work-related violence. Violence can occur despite an employer's best efforts to provide a safe environment. It can result in injury, disability, or death, and can create financial consequences such as lost productivity and even lawsuits. Some employers face the risk that employees will be kidnapped, and the severity of the loss in that case depends on whether the employee is a key employee. There are several techniques that are used to manage losses relating to injury and illness. Let's go through those. First of all, we could use avoidance, and that would reduce the loss potential to zero, obviously. Let's say that in one of our products that we're manufacturing, we use a certain type of paint, and we discover that that paint is emitting a vapor that's causing people to become ill. We can switch to a different paint. Loss prevention is another strategy that includes safety engineering and workplace design. Loss reduction, having a plan to restore an injured person to a level of independence after they're injured. We also have separation. Separation is a strategy that can be used. Arranging activities so no single event can cause multiple losses. Maybe we can use separate routes for delivery trucks. And duplication is also a strategy that can be used, creating backup facilities, and that would include cross-training employees. So if one employee gets injured or becomes sick, another employee can step in and do his or her job while that employee is gone. So let's do a practice question. This is an accept question. All of the following represent types of human resource risk except. So three of these are human resource risk. One of them is not. We have work-related injury, retirement, work-related violence, and embezzlement. Well, work-related injury, retirement, and work-related violence are all types of human resource risk. However, embezzlement is a type of property risk. And since this is an accept question, we're looking for the one that is not a type of human resource risk. So therefore, D is our answer, and that concludes Module 5.